Okay. Lord, thank you so much for today, God. Thank you for this beautiful weather that we've been having. I thank you for the sunshine, God, and we're all getting our vitamin D. Lord, I just pray for tonight that you would just speak through me. Just bless this time, Lord. I pray for the family of whoever's service is going on in the main sanctuary. I just pray that you would just bless them, give them peace, and just be with everyone in there right now. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. So tonight we're going to talk about how accurate is the Bible. And I used to call this how reliable is the Bible, but then a church asked me to come and speak on, well, that's great that it's reliable, but we want to know how accurate it is. We want the like nitty-gritty of the accuracy of the Bible. So I retitled this, and I like these slides a little bit better. They're a little more recent, so this version is called How Accurate is the Bible? Obviously, the question is how accurate compared to what, right? Because with history, we've got all these things what we determine whether or not a historical document is accurate. Was it written by that person at that time? How do we determine these things? What's the test for that kind of stuff? What should we or what can we compare it to? Because we can't determine accuracy unless we have some type of bar of accuracy that we have to compare it to. So obviously we're not deciding what truth is in a vacuum, or what's accurate in a vacuum. So we have to figure out what we should be comparing it to. So just out of curiosity, what do you guys think we should be comparing the accuracy of the Bible to?
One thing might be the historical documents.
Right, historical documents. So what's another way of looking at a historical document? We can take it as what? Truth, right. So we have to determine what is truth, how can we find out truth? And then once we know what truth is, we can say, okay, now we can use that test to determine if the Bible is actually true or accurate. Obviously, we talked about this a little bit, so I don't have to go really into depth on the different types of truth and how you can determine it. But we can all agree, or we do, based on what we talked about before, is that there is some form of absolute truth in the world that we can use as a measuring rod to decide what is true and what is not true. So an example of that, like we talked about, would be like something like math, or something that everyone has consensusively determined to be accurate and in reality. So obviously correspondence theory, we talked a little bit about that. That which conforms to the facts corresponds to reality or expresses things as they are. So Dr. Grutheis says, a belief or statement is only true if it matches with, reflects, or corresponds to the reality that it refers to. For a statement to be true, it must be factual. Facts determine truth or falsity of a belief or a statement. It is the nature and meaning of truth to be fact-dependent. A statement is never true simply because someone thinks or utters it. We may be entitled to our own opinions, but we are not entitled to our own facts. Believing a statement is one thing. That statement being true is another. So he talks about just because we have a perception of something or we have an opinion of something, that doesn't automatically make it true. We're all entitled to those things. We're all entitled to our beliefs and our views on things, but that doesn't necessarily make it true for everyone in all places and all times. So if truth is that which lines up with the facts, then what are the facts? Obviously, we talk about finding facts and building a case that requires evidence. So we have to gather evidence to determine whether or not a case can be put forth as able to be determined whether it's true or false. So in a court case, what do you have to do? You have to gather evidence, and then everyone consensually decided this is enough evidence to determine whether something's true or not. Because you obviously shouldn't put your faith in something you can't verify. John Lennox said, faith is not a leap in the dark. It's the exact opposite. It's a commitment based on evidence. So now we talk about, well, what's evidence? What can we say is something that everyone would agree this is something that can be used as evidence for the Bible or for whatever, for a court case? There's two different types. There's external and internal. And I talked a tiny bit about this before, but those are the two types of evidence that there are. Obviously, we'll talk a little bit about the internal evidence in the Bible, but almost every Christian agrees that the Bible declares itself the Word of God. So we have to move beyond that, and we have to talk about, okay, well, how are we going to convince the non-Christians? Well, we have to talk about external evidence at that point, and that's where we talk about history and manuscripts and things like that. So most of the time tonight is going to be spent on what we call external evidence. External evidence would be similar to kind of what Sherlock Holmes does. He would be an example of someone that uses external evidence to build a case to determine what actually happened. So he doesn't look at, obviously very rarely can he ask the person who's killed, what happened to you? That would be an immediate source. That would be internal evidence saying, okay, I was attacked and this is what happened to me. Well, that's internal evidence. That's great. But there's something outside to verify that. What you have to have is witnesses. You have to have documents. You have to have things outside to determine whether someone's actually telling the truth or not. So with under external evidence, there's three types of external evidence. There's evidence of sense. And again, I talked a little bit about this before, but I was a little bit jumbled because I didn't have my notes in front of me. Demonstration and moral proof. So these actually were put together. The only time I've ever actually seen these in writing with such a great explanation is the very first ever published female apologist in 1728. These are in her book, and I'm in the process of updating it and a commentary to it, and I'm going to publish it. But for right now, I'm giving you guys a little scoop of what's to come. So in her book, she gives these three different types of external evidence. And I think that they're great because I think they're things that we kind of all just accept as being good evidence, but we never really thought to put it in certain categories or different things like that. So obviously the first one is evidence of sense. That would be our own senses that are evidence to us of certain facts. This is using our eyes, ears to gather facts about the world around us. So for example, if I say, what color is that wall? Be blue, gray, whatever. That would be, or what color is a flag? Red, white, and blue. So that's something that we can use to determine, okay, this is a truth. That I'm seeing this. You can't deny it. We're all sitting here. We all see the same thing, unless you're colorblind, which there are things like that. But, you know, when we're talking about people that aren't impaired in some way, majority of people who have no impairments would say, okay, that is red, white, and blue, or whatever. So we have evidence of sense. So that would be something like Kant. He would say you can only determine what's true by what your senses tell you, right? You can't know anything outside of your senses. So it's only what your eyes, ears, nose, touch kind of tell you about the world. He says that we don't have any preconceived things. We're not born with any knowledge inside of our head. Everything that you gain is through your senses in life. So that would be an example of evidence of sense. There's demonstration. Where we can, by our own powers, find connections between truth and from things known and discover others unknown. So this would be a scientific method. We can demonstrate that something is true, that it works, that it does a certain thing every time for all people in all places. This is also deducting, basically looking at two pieces of information and deciding how they're related to each other or if they're related to each other. You can say, okay, that's interesting because I'm reading this historical document, it talks about this pilgrimage that happened in this year with these people, and then I'm reading this other historical document that's talking about this group of people that went missing around the same time, and you can kind of make these deductions that, oh, maybe they're the same people, and then that's how we learn new historical theories, and that's how we learn, right? So then there's also moral proof, the testimony of persons concerning the evidence of their senses and an appearance of circumstances and things. Obviously, that would be an eyewitness. So moral proof is the testimony of an eyewitness. So, deductions. And then this would be testimony of eyewitnesses. So, lucky for us, we actually have all of these when it comes to whether the Bible is true or not, right? So we can read the Bible and we can say, that makes sense, that doesn't make sense, that really happened in history, that didn't happen in history. We have demonstration, we have a scientific method, we can look at the science in the Bible and we can say, yes, that is how the laws of nature work, that is how the world works, that does make sense with what we know about the universe. And then moral proof, testimony by witnesses, obviously with that we have the Gospels and the Gospel writers and testimony of the first century church, right? So all of these within, there's going to be the evidence for the Bible. So all of these things are in the evidence for the Bible, which is what I call maps. So I'm a huge fan of acronyms because, again, my memory is awful and this helps me remember things. So MAPS is how I remember the case for the veracity of the Bible. How do I know whether the Bible is true or not? If someone asks me, well, the Bible's been changed, you know, so many times over the years, how do you know that it's true? And I'm like, okay, well, MAPS, okay. Let's talk about manuscripts. And then I keep going and, you know, it's all the rest of the acronyms. So it helps me to remember when I'm talking to somebody. I may not remember every single point under each one of those things, but it'll give me enough to where I can actually have a conversation with somebody and have a starting point. And then I can say, you know what, I kind of forgot this one part, but I can email that to you later or whatever. Because obviously we want to make sure these things are not just conducive in our brains, but that we also can use them for evangelism. So M is for manuscripts. The Bible has more manuscript evidence than any other book from the ancient world. Now, every time we talk about the Bible, we're talking about anything that is related to history. So when we talk about M and A, these two are history related. So when we talk about these two, we divide them both up into historical periods. So they're both going to be divided up into BC. Because there's a whole section of stuff that's BC for this, and a whole section of stuff that's AD, and a whole section of BC, and a whole section of AD. So there's a lot to remember, but because they are historical ones, we break them up into BC and AD, because we want to have some type of historical context for these things. So first, manuscripts, BC, that would be Old Testament, right? So that would be the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, like, for example, if I was going to be out evangelizing, I might put this on an index card, and then I might put this on an index card. I carry index cards and little notebooks around with me in my purse with these little things on them because that way I don't have to remember them. But I'll read enough and know enough to talk about the veracity of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it'll get me there if I have all this with me. So you don't need to write everything about the Dead Sea Scrolls unless you want another little index card that's just Dead Sea Scrolls facts. But this will kind of give you a little bit of a context and a map for how all this stuff fits together. So manuscripts, BC, Dead Sea Scrolls. So obviously that is our greatest evidence. Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1947. So here's the thing. Before 1947, we were like, we got nothing. How do we prove the Old Testament? And it was really hard, too, because we also didn't have the technology we have in archaeology either, which I'll get to that a little bit later. So, like, 100 years ago, we were struggling. We had just basically, like, okay, here's what the traditions say, and we didn't really have the science or the scholarship to really back up what we were saying because we didn't have the technology to find these things. And so 100 years ago, I mean, we were really struggling, which is why I think the skepticism in the Enlightenment period and in the early modern and the modern period in England, I think that's why it was so easy for them to take hold, because we didn't have anything to fight with. We had no evidence to fight with. We just had, well, here's the tradition of our church fathers, and that was pretty much it. And then they weren't even the greatest people. So now you've got, like, okay, you know, like, you've got these people like Augustine who, like, write about all this great theology, but he was a bad dude. Like, he did not have the greatest. So, you know, here we are trying to prove these things are true, but yet we're using the testimony of flawed men, right? So that we had nothing, no external evidence outside of something in order, outside of them, in order to say, yes, what they're saying is true, regardless of what their character is like. And so, like I said, 100 years ago, I think that's really why we struggled to answer, and I think that's why we lost the battle. But now, luckily, and I think this is why apologetics has been revitalized in the last 30, 50 years, whatever it is because now we have stuff to use, and now we're like, yay, we finally have evidence. And so I think that's why it's been revitalized, and that's why I think it was dead for so long. You know, obviously the first few centuries we had these great apologists, but then kind of died a little bit, right? And then now all of a sudden we have all these apologists again. It's because we found the evidence, you know? So But okay, so 1947. So think about this. Before 1947, we really didn't have much to prove that the Old Testament was true or that it was even written by the people at the time that we believed it was. So that's when you started getting all of the people who were critiquing Isaiah. Well, Isaiah was written by so many different people, and then you started getting the ones that said the Olshausen hypothesis, where it's, you know, four different people wrote Genesis, and, you know, all these people talking about ripping the Pentateuch up into, you know, the JEPD, the Deuteronomy hypothesis theory, where you have, oh, there's different authors or different editors, because we had nothing to fight that with. And so it permeated culture and became an accepted scholarship, and it became higher criticism because we had nothing to fight it with. So the Dead Sea Scrolls were originally in the possession of the Qumran sect of people that were believed to be a group of ascetic Jews, and probably could be the Essenes. The interesting thing is in the book The Da Vinci Code, so if you want to talk a little pop culture, one of the characters actually says the Dead Sea Scrolls were the earliest Christian documents in history. Why is that a correct statement? They're right. Christianity wasn't even around yet when the Dead Sea Scrolls were written. And so it's crazy because you'll read these things, and he's supposedly the expert that the guy that Robert Langdon, the character, goes to find out what the truth is about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he says, well, they're the earliest Christian documents. Well, no, they're not even Christian at all. They're Jewish. And so it's interesting because you have a lot of, we have to be careful to talk to people about, okay, well, what's actually true about this and what's not true about this, you know, and make sure that people understand that. Okay, so what scrolls were found? 11 caves. We just found one more. I don't know if you guys heard about that, but just recently we found another cave. 11 caves yielded over 900 biblical and non-biblical texts composed of tens of thousands of manuscript fragments. Over 220 texts of the Hebrew Bible, except for the book of Esther. Can anybody guess why Esther was left out? What's different about the book of Esther than any other book of the Bible?
Doesn't mention God.
Therefore, they didn't believe it was worthy of being a biblical or a preserved the way that they did. They're a mystical kind of cult, so they believed in great power in the name of God. They didn't write the name of God when they were copying, you know, and all that, and we have proof of that. So because God was not mentioned, the book of Esther was not there. The scrolls are written in Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek, dating from 250 BC to AD 68. So this is obviously during the time of Alexandrian, you know, Greece. Alexander comes in and takes over in, what, 300 BC. And then in 70 BC, you have the Romans come in. And so that's why you have this mix of Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek, because you've got the Jews still coming from Babylon, which has a little bit of the Aramaic, and then you've got the Hebrew from the Jewish sect, and then you've got the Greek of the day. So you've got all these different languages kind of happening at the same time, and everybody's speaking these languages. Most people were trilingual because they had to be in this culture. So it's not surprising that we would find documents written in all of the tongues, even though it's a Jewish area. Of these texts, over 40 are apocryphal and pseudepigraphal literature. Pseudepigraphal just means that it is falsely attributed to an author. So the Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is pseudepigraphal because they believe that it was not written by Enoch. It may be true or it may have some truth in it, but it's not biblical because we don't believe Enoch actually wrote it. So that's a pseudepigraphal. It's basically false writing, pseudo writings.
How did they get those dates?
Because that's when, well, first of all, they did use carbon dating. They've used, like, all what you, because you can use it to that point. But also because of the stuff that was in it, because some of them weren't just biblical things. They were about the Qumran community, and that's when the Qumran community was around and all this stuff was happening. So I did it by historical context, by carbon dating, and lots of other different chemicals.
They didn't actually date their writings.
They may have, but I think it's mostly because of, like, the type of papyrus that was used, or, like, if it was goat skin, or, like, whatever was the what's that called?
The medium.
Thank you, the medium. The medium used, they can date that by chemical analysis, and then just other various things they've used to date particular things. The most interesting thing is that I was actually went to Dallas, Texas a few years ago for a conference with Josh McDowell, and he had actually bought these Egyptian mummy masks. And back a long time ago, when the Christians were in Egypt, after Jesus was resurrected, the poor people would go to the garbage dump and they would get paper. And they would use paper to actually make the burial masks of the people that they were burying, because they didn't have enough money for like clay or whatever the medium was that they needed. So what happened is they would go to the garbage dump. And remember, we're talking like Library of Alexandria at this time. Like, so we've got scholars and people living in Egypt at this point that are writing a lot about Christianity, a lot about history. So what was happening is you had all these scribes that were copying manuscripts. And what would happen is if they, you know, made one tiny little mistake, but they had to go throw it away, right? So they had these huge garbage dumps full of paper or papyrus. Well, what happened is the poor people would go to the garbage dumps and take all the pieces of paper, and they would actually kind of do a paper mache and make like a burial mask for their family or whatever. And they would paint them, and they're beautiful, right? Well, it turns out what's happening is that when these things are dug up, the museums are super interested in the mummy, but they don't care about the mask. Well, what we have found out, if you take the mask off, the mask actually has manuscripts and things in them that are data, and they haven't been touched in thousands of years because it's been buried with this mummy. So anyways, Josh McDowell was part of a group that found a couple, and the year before I went, this is where they found a first century piece of mark. And so, which hasn't been published yet because they're still haggling over it. But the year after I went, he actually had a mask, and we were actually able to pull it apart and kind of see the pieces as, like, for the first time ever, these were coming out. And the crazy thing is there's this guy there, and his whole job is what he does is he just pulls out, like, we would pull it apart, find the pieces, and then he would just look at it, and he'd be like, oh, yeah, this is Coptic, you know, blah, blah, dated this year. And it would be like he would know just based on the writing style what time period it's from and what date it's from. I mean, this is what it was about. Like, it was crazy. I mean, he knew so much. It was ridiculous. So he actually used to acquire things for the Green family, who are building the Museum of the Bible in D.C. They own Hobby Lobby. So he used to be their, like, acquisitions guy. So he'd go all over the world and acquire and verify, you know, whether or not these things were accurate. So he was at the conference, and it was really cool because we would literally be pulling these things out for the first time in thousands of years, and he would just look at it and be like, oh, yeah, I know what this is. And we found actually quite a few pieces, like I think a passage of 1 Corinthians, and then we found like a piece of a play that hadn't been published, like there was no other copies of it. Like, so we found all this crazy stuff, and Josh McDowell has, I think, published about it or is going to. And we're all listed as co-finders, which is pretty cool. But yeah, so it's crazy because even if you didn't have things like carbon dating or, you know, scientific ways of figuring out when something is from, you have people who are such experts that they can tell you based on the type of language style or what was used or how it was written when it's from. And so that's basically how they date these things. There are just people who just know this stuff. And the craziest thing is he had this infrared piece of technology where he would actually put the manuscript piece in an infrared technology, and then he could actually see if it had been used and then erased and then reused. He could read what was underneath. Or if it was pressed up against another piece of manuscript, if we didn't have that, he could read what was on that based on what had been pushed onto the other piece of paper. So, I mean, there's just a lot of crazy ways now because of technology that we are able to find things that we were never able to see before. So it's insane. It gets me all excited.
Can I ask a question about carbon dating?
Yeah.
It's always a disaster when the evolutionists do it.
Right.
And I think it's because of the number of...
Well, they're trying to go too far back, yes.
Yeah, but when we apply it to scripture, it doesn't go back that far, so the carbon dating is much more accurate.
Right. Yes. Yeah, because if there are carbonaceous materials that they're using, like, so papyrus, for example, it's a carbon life form. They're using, you know, like goat, I don't know, whatever, skin. That stuff has carbon in it. And because it's been decaying or whatever. And so we can determine, because it does have carbon and because it's not that far, the carbon half-life is easier to measure because we're not trying to go millions of years. We're only trying to go a couple thousand. Because for us, all we need is a few thousand. We don't need these things to be dated millions of years. We just need them to be dated in the thousands of years that they're supposed to be. And so for us, it's great for modern things. It doesn't work for things that go too far back. Okay, and then also 200 texts pertaining to the Qumran sect. So we learned a lot about these people based on these documents that we found. Talks about the way that they do prayer, the way that they cleanse, the way that they require, you know, certain things, eating habits, kind of very similar to like Leviticus, similar to that. It would be how they lived and what made them different from other sects of Jews. We also found a scriptorium. Basically had... it showed like where the scholars would actually sit and or the scribes would sit and copy the manuscripts. So we know this was a manuscript producing environment. So we found them at the source, basically, of where they were copied. They found a copper ink pot, stone benches and tables, things that would show that this is probably what was happening at this place. They probably were there for the specific purpose of copying and doing documents, which doesn't surprise us because later on we see the, you know, more ascetic Christians, like the monks, they lived in monasteries and they just copied manuscripts. So this is kind of the precursor to the medieval Christianity that we would see that in. Cave 1, we found a complete book of Isaiah, which is now the oldest complete manuscript of any book of the Bible. This is huge for us because we did have that issue where we had a higher critic saying, Isaiah is written by multiple authors, and because we found a complete piece of it together, dated so close to the actual Isaiah, it kind of gave us a little bit more footing to stand on to say that, no, this is probably just one author. Also found was another incomplete book of Isaiah, Habakkuk commentary, various non-biblical books such as the Thanksgiving Scroll and the Manual of Discipline, and then fragments of various parts of the Bible. Also, Daniel 2:4, where Hebrew changes to Aramaic. So some people are like, why do you do that? Why do you, you know, how do you know that it was Aramaic and not one section? And because the original manuscript shows a switch from the languages. So that's pretty cool. The Isaiah scroll was written in Hebrew on parchment or animal skin, dated to 125 BC, and is approximately 26 feet long. I don't know if you guys have ever seen this in real life, but it's really cool. They actually shows when they bring the Dead Sea Scrolls around, so you can see them. The above scroll is open to 38:9 to 40:28, which may indicate the scribes believe the book was written by only one author. That's where they believe the break happens between those two. They say, oh, author one wrote this part, and author two wrote this part. They believe the break happens in between those verses. But because you can see this scroll, it's just continuously copied. They believe it was one author and it wasn't different authors. And the reason they attack Isaiah so much is because it's such a prophetic book that they're like, oh, there's no way one person could have written that so many hundreds of years before Jesus came or whatever. There had to be later authors who edited it and changed it, and, you know, because heaven forbid prophecy be true, you know. So scrolls of Cave 2. Cave 2 is not as productive, but by 1952, it produced hundreds of fragments, including two of Exodus, one of Leviticus, four of Numbers, two of Deuteronomy, one of Jeremiah, Job, Psalms, and two of Ruth. So the crazy thing is that, so you can even see the above fragments of Leviticus were purchased in 2005, originally found toward the Dead Sea. So here's the problem. The problem is that the Bedouin shepherds that found this area, not all of the scrolls got to the right people. So a lot of the things that were happening is like, oh, wait, there's these valuable scrolls that the Christian community and the Jewish community want. So now they're like, okay, this is something that we can use to hold over them or sell. So what happens is if people find out about these things before they've been authenticated and proven to the world or shown to the world, they get stolen and sold in the black market. And that's one of the problems that we're having in the community today. And Scott Carroll talked a lot about this. He's like, it jacks up the prices. Once they find out you want these things, then now all of a sudden they become too expensive for the average person to buy, which is why there are probably hundreds and thousands more out there, but we can't afford to buy them because they're so expensive and they're being sold in the black market. So you can see this was purchased in 2005. That little fragment itself is probably thousands and thousands of dollars. And it's crazy because it's like this big, you know. Because they know that we want them. And so they're willing to jack up the price on us. This is a really cool thing. I've been doing a lot of research into this because I just think it's a fascinating mystery. Scrolls of K3, they didn't have any biblical significance, but a unique discovery was two rolls of Hebrew text written on copper. This is known as the Copper Scroll. The text lists 60-plus sites of buried treasure in the area of the Judean desert. Nobody has found them yet, and they can't figure out the archaic instructions. So it's like this big mystery, and like there's like people have written like novels about like, you know, treasure hunters that have tried to find this. And I think one guy even actually, like, if you go to copperscroll.com or something, like his whole life's goal is to like find all this. And so there are people, you know, out there doing that. But it's cool because, you know, it's just an interesting, you know, just kind of an interesting thing. You know, who knows what's in those places? It's crazy. But obviously the crazy thing about it is, and one thing that shows the greatness of our technology, is that they couldn't unroll it because it was too fragile. They didn't want to damage it. So what they did is they x-rayed it to discover its contents. So they were able to read it based on just using x-ray without actually having to take it apart. They did eventually cut it into strips, and you can see them when you go see the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's pretty cool. Obviously it's green because it's oxidized copper, but it's pretty neat. Scrolls of K4. K4 was perhaps the most productive of all the caves excavated, producing some 100 biblical books and containing more than 50,000 fragments. Among them was partial copies and fragments of Genesis, Daniel 7:28-8:1, again, where the Aramaic switches back to Hebrew, so that's interesting. So we know when the changes happened, because we have before and after. Commentaries on Psalms, Isaiah, and Nahum, and then 40,000 fragments were found beneath the floor of K4. So it's interesting because the theory is that the reason they found them, they were all stuffed in jars and hidden, or they were buried. And so the idea is that maybe when the Romans sacked Jerusalem and everyone had to leave, that they may have like gotten buried or put away very quickly with the idea that they would come back and get them someday, but they never were able to. Because of the unrest in the Middle East. And so it's crazy because a lot of it, you can tell, is basically just kind of buried and shoved places. And so that's why it's hard to find things, because who knows where they put stuff. There was no order to how they put things away, basically. We also have Messianic testimony, which is important because if we're talking about Messianic testimony, they say, oh, there was no prophecy of Jesus before he came. Well, now we not only have biblical, but we have historical proof that there was Messianic prophecies before Jesus came. So discovered in 1952, first century BC Hebrew, remember that's 100 years before Jesus came, contains Messianic passages from the Hebrew Bible identifying him as prophet, priest, and king. So we have Deuteronomy and Numbers and Joshua all giving prophecies. And it was all together. So it's almost like someone basically took all the Messianic passages from those areas and put them all in one document, kind of like a commentary or a list. But it's all put together 100 years before Christ came. And so now we have historical evidence that there was prophecy of that type of figure before he came. But you can see why they were confused, because he was named as a prophet, a king, and a priest. There's no Isaiah 50 there, or 55 talks about him as a suffering servant. Obviously, they did have that, the Isaiah scroll, but you know, when they're talking about, okay, we put together all of the Messianic passages, it's like, well, those are, you know, the popular Messianic passages with the Jews, right, where he comes as a conquering king, and, you know, it's not the suffering servant that we all come to. So it's not surprising that they're like, when Jesus showed up, they were like, what? Wait, we were expecting somebody else, you know. Scrolls of cave 5 through 10, fragments of up to 50 in non-biblical, non-biblical texts. Cave 6, fragments from Genesis, Exodus, Daniel, Deuteronomy, and Ecclesiastes. Cave 7 had Greek documents, which may be the earliest portions of nine New Testament books. Remember, because Mark was done before the fall of Jerusalem. Actually, we believe most of the New Testament was done before the fall of Jerusalem, but we definitely know Mark was. And so there are some Greek passages with Mark in there. Cave 8 contained fragments of Genesis and Psalms. Cave 9 and 10 was unproductive, yielding only a single ostraca, which I'm not quite sure what that is, along with leather materials used for storing and bundling scrolls. And actually, just so you guys know, these aren't my slides, but I'll tell you where you can get them after. Cave 11, we had a partial copy of Leviticus. Targum of Job was found, partial copy of Psalms. We now have 40 canonical Psalms, ranging from Psalm 90 to 150. We have two of the three non-biblical temple scrolls, the longest measuring nearly 28 feet. So temple scrolls were different from actual scrolls. Temple scrolls were actually for use in service. So they're usually sturdier, they're usually a little bit bigger. Josh McDowell has one, and I think Veritas Seminary has one. And then I think Southern Evangelical Seminary has one as well. And then the Museum of the Bible was actually, the first part of their collection is at Biola, is housed at Biola, and they have a few of them there. So if you ever want to see them, I don't know if they have everything on display all the time, but I know they've got some of it housed there. Because originally it started in Southern California, and then now it's going to all be Washington, D.C. Okay, so now what's the accuracy? People are like, great, you found all these things, but how do we know they were copied accurately? Well, before we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, remember I told you we found them in 1947, and before then we didn't really have much to stand on because we didn't have anything to combat the higher criticism with. So now, before 1947, all we had was the Masoretic text, which dated to 900 AD. That was the only complete copy we had. It was the oldest and complete copy of the Old Testament. So, but that's still, 1,000 years removed from when these things are supposed to be happening. So now we're like, okay, how do we prove that this is accurate when it's 1,000 years removed from the events that happened? So even though we may say, okay, it's accurate, well, we don't know that for sure. But the crazy thing is that when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, again, closed the gap by 1,000 years, because they're, 100 years B.C. to when things are actually happening, it closed the gap by 1,000 years, and it's 95% identical. So the Masoretic text is 95% identical to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's awesome, because that means that for the first 1,000 years of the church, or the first 2,000 years of the church, let's say, because we didn't find it until 1947, we still had an accurate copy of the Bible. And that's important because people are going to say, oh, the Bible was changed all throughout the year, all these editors, all these people came along and changed it. Well, it's not actually true. It's 95% identical to the 125 BC Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's huge for us, because not only did we get manuscripts dating to the time these things happened, but now they're also accurately copied. Obviously, when you say 95%, you're going to get those lovely people who are like, but what's that 5%? What is that? Maybe it's doctrinal. It's not doctrinal. It's nothing that affects doctrinal content. So 5% difference is due to spelling differences, word order, minor scribal error, which affects no major doctrine. So an example of that, kinds of scribal errors. There are 400,000 variant readings in the Bible, but that's good, because that means that not everyone got together and copied each other, right? Because they didn't all get together and confer on a story and decide, well, this is the one we're going to give to the world, which is what happened with the Quran. They're different, but they're not different enough to change anything. But they're different to show style, or to show the fact that there are multiple versions of this, and because we have multiple versions by multiple different people or multiple different scribes, we can verify that these things actually happened, because now you've got multiple eyewitnesses to the same thing happening, right? So there's four categories of error, basically relating to human limitations, human error. Fusion, joining words together when they should be separated, so now here would sometimes become nowhere or something like that. Dittography, which is writing twice, which should only be written once. Like, have you ever been like watching TV, like when you're supposed to be writing something and you actually write the same thing twice, or you start writing what somebody's saying on the TV instead of what you're actually supposed to be copying, stuff like that. Homeoteleituon, the eye skips to the same word on the different line, omitting passages. Transposition, the reversal of the position of two letters or words. Obviously, if you guys saw J-S-E-U-S, you would still assume it's Jesus. So nothing that you would make you go, oh, I wonder if that's really what this is. Phonetic error, confusing words that sound the same but are spelled differently. So there or there, which we still do that, right? That's still a huge problem. I hate it when I see that on the internet. I'm like, ugh. But the great thing is, because we have so many variations of the same passages, we know what the majority of them are trying to say. And that's what's the most important thing. So people are like, oh, it's bad that you have so many different variant. No, it's not. It's good because they're all recording the same thing, but there's enough differences, like I said, to verify that, okay, this person spelled this thing wrong, but in three others of the same passage, they spelled it this way. So that must be the way it's spelled. And so we can verify based on that. So that is Old Testament. So before I go to New Testament, does anybody have any questions?
How do some of the skeptics answer the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Basically they say, oh, they've been tampered with, or they're not accurate, or they just say, so what? You know? There's lots of... The thing is that because they still are a relatively recent find, and we're still finding them, their argument is that, well, you're going to find some someday that contradict everything, or, you know, or you've only found so many, or they don't, like I said, they don't even talk about it. So I'm sure you could find people who, like, well, like I said, like atheist and agnostic skeptic Bart Ehrman, you know, he's a New Testament scholar, but he's not a believer. And, you know, but he says even, like, look, the manuscripts are accurate, you know, so they'll admit that, but they'll say, but it doesn't mean that it's supernatural, is basically what their kind of argument is. Doesn't mean that it's from God. So, New Testament. So now we're going into AD. New Testament. New Testament has more manuscripts, earlier manuscripts, and more accurately copied manuscripts than any other book from the ancient world. So we'll go through each one of those. So first, there are more. How many more? What are the numbers? Well, the numbers are, sorry, it's a little bit off with the lines. Plato, and remember, not only do you have to have a lot, you have to have, the gap has to be close, right? Because myth and legend can creep in. So the gap from the original to the first published copy has to be small. And then you have to have lots. So this number should be big and this number should be small. That's basically what I'm saying. So Plato's dialogues, Homer's Iliad, Herodotus, Aristotle, all of these things, I mean, really, historians or philosophers, have they ever questioned whether or not these things are written by these people? No, they teach them as fact in college, right? You go to college, I know because I took philosophy. This person wrote this at this date, no questions asked. But yet the manuscript evidence compared to what we have in the New Testament is nowhere near. Yet what's the one that's always questioned, right? The New Testament's always the one that's questioned. So you can see, like Julius Caesar, the gap between the original was 950 years. There's 10 manuscript copies. The only one that comes close is Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad, 500-year gap, 643 copies. That's probably the best one you can see on this list. It doesn't even come close to the New Testament Greek manuscripts. 30 to 300-year gap, 5,700-plus copies. So we, like, destroy any other ancient book that there is, yet we are questioned more than any of the rest of them. So it's just, it's craziness. And this is just the Greek ones, just Greek New Testament, right? So this is not Old Testament, this is not other languages, this is just Greek New Testament manuscripts. We have 5,700 plus. Now, if you want an idea of what all of the languages look like in more of a picture form instead of words, this is what it would look like. So here's the New Testament with 24,000 plus manuscripts. Just New Testament. Remember, we're not talking about Dead Sea Scrolls. We're talking about just New Testament manuscripts. 24,000 in all different languages. Now, if you put it in a pictogram, that's what the size of it would be, and the closest one that even is anywhere near is Homer, with 643 copies still in the Greek. And so it's crazy, because we really have embarrassment of riches when it comes to how many manuscripts we have compared to other ancient books. However, does that ever get told to anybody? No. They never talk about that in college. I went to secular college. I took so many Bible, so many literature, so many philosophy classes, so many religion classes. Never got mentioned. Not once. And so it's just crazy because we have it. We have the manuscript evidence, and there's no contest, but no one ever talks about it, right? So not only do we have more, 24,000 compared to the closest one at 643, right? There are earlier. So we have a smaller gap between our manuscripts than other ones do. Remember I said Homer's the closest at 500 years. Well, we had 1 Corinthians 15, which, what? It was written in Paul's lifetime, which has been dated to within, what, 15 to 20 years after Christ's resurrection. And it's the first, basically, the first creed. And so we just blow everyone else out of the water. So the New Testament is about a 25 to 150-year gap. Obviously, the New Testament was closed with the Apostle John, with the Isle of Patmos in 90 AD. Whether it happened before that or at that time, still, we had it done before the end of the first century. The earliest passage we have, or the earliest manuscript we have, is John Ryland Papyrus, which is dated at about 117 AD. It's got 5 verses from John 18. And like I said, so right now that's the earliest. But however, we whether they have published or not yet, we do think we have a piece of mark that is first century, so before 100 AD. But they'll eventually publish about that whenever they finish haggling over the date and all that. Bodmer Papyri is the next one at 200 AD, most of John, 1st, 2nd Peter, and Jude. Chester Beatty Papyri, 250 AD, nearly all the New Testament books. Vaticanus Manuscript, around 325 to 50 AD, most of the Old Testament and the New Testament. So the crazy thing is that when you talk to people about what was happening in the early church, they'll all say, oh, well, the Bible was put together at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. That's what you'll hear, right? But the Bible was actually canonized well before that. The New Testament had been decided upon, and everything was basically already decided by the time of that. And the reason we know that is because we have the writings of the early church fathers who recorded the lists of what was in the canon at the time and what wasn't. And so we know that these things were actually dated, they were decided upon way before 325 AD. Council of Nicaea, the whole point of that was what? To determine how we talk about the deity of Christ, right? How do we discuss Arius and how do we talk about whether Jesus is fully God, fully man, and how do we talk about that? It wasn't, is he God? That had been decided in the New Testament in the first 100 years. It was, how do we talk about it? How do we define it? And that's when they came up with the hypostatic union. Is 100% God, 100% man. And so that was what was happening at the Council of Nicaea. It was talk about the heresies about Christ and how do we actually determine or define what he was. It was not to decide what goes in the Bible, which is the common misconception, which is what you'll be told at college. You'll be told, oh, it was when they decided what goes in the Bible. That's not what happened. A noted manuscript expert, Sir Frederick Kenyon, says the interval between the dates of the original composition and the earliest evidence becomes so small as to be, in fact, negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as firmly established. So because we have so much, we can basically say, look, any argument you have against it, the manuscripts speak for themselves. To kind of get an idea of the timeline, you have the cross, either at 30 AD or slightly thereafter. You have the creed of 1 Corinthians 15 at that point. You have the Apostles' Creed basically in Acts 2. You have Peter saying what they believed and preaching the gospel. And then you have, 40, 50 AD, the church is kind of figuring out who they are, what they're doing, missionary journeys and all that stuff. And then you have 1 Corinthians 15, which is the first recorded, written down account of the resurrection. And then you have Mark and Luke, we know for sure, were done before 60 AD, simply because Acts was completed at that point. And Acts, obviously, is after Luke, so we know because of the way that Luke wrote, Luke had to be finished before Acts. And then Mark was done before that. Mark was probably the earliest finished gospel. So because of the things that they wrote about, that's how we kind of determine. We know that James and Paul wrote before 70 AD,
We know most of the New Testament was done by 70 AD, except for maybe John, John's writings, because what? The Romans sacked Jerusalem, right? And the temple was destroyed, and they were all dispersed. And that would have been recorded somewhere if that had happened before the New Testament was finished, right? They would have written about that. They would have been writing to their fellow believers in other places rather than Jerusalem if it was after 70 AD. So we know probably because of the history that most of the New Testament was completed by 70 AD. The great thing about that is that it's during the age of the eyewitnesses. So people who were alive when Jesus was preaching and died and was resurrected are still alive at this point, right? Because it's still within their generation. So the great thing about that is that now you've got people who can say, wait a minute, that didn't happen, right? So we know for a fact that they're probably trustworthy because these things were circulating. And you had Paul sending Phoebe around with different epistles to different churches. So we know that they were circulating before the New Testament was finished. And so if these things didn't happen, somebody would have said, wait a minute, Paul, that didn't happen. Or wait a minute, you know. And the crazy thing is that, again, like I was telling you guys before, the Gary Habermas, if you guys can see his human timeline of the early church, it's interesting because he talks about how many times Paul went back to Peter, James, and John and said, what really happened? He made sure that what he was saying was the truth. And he constantly, I think three times, went back and said, is this the actual account? Is this what happened? I need to know that this is the truth. And we know that there were some times when Peter and Paul disagreed on different things, how to preach to the Gentiles and the Jews and stuff like that. But we know that Paul conferred with them multiple times and made sure that what he was saying was what actually happened. And we know that they obviously were around during the time of Christ because they were his closest disciples, and then James was his brother. And James is a great one. Why? Because James saw everything that happened but was a non-believer until after the resurrection. So he's a great one because people are like, oh, well, Paul didn't believe until, you know, way after, and so he didn't see any of Christ's life and this and that. But James did. James was there, and he saw everything. So something must have happened where James saw and was like, okay, I believe now. You know, there must have been something. Okay, what is the evidence for early New Testament authorship? Obviously, we have other first century and second century books that cite the New Testament. So like I said, we have writings by the early church fathers. We have other authors that are quoting the New Testament in the first century. And it's like, well, wait a minute, how could they quote it if it wasn't circulating at that point? So we know for a fact that it was probably already circulating by the end of the first century because other people were quoting it. Critical scholars agree that 1 Corinthians was written by 55 to 56 AD, Acts was 62 AD, and Luke was written sometime before Acts, obviously, because they were in order in 61 AD. Any dates in the first century are too early to allow mythological development. So that's how we know, because these things are dated that early, because other people were quoting them at that time, we know they were well circulated, which means they had to have been written well before the time they were circulated. And we know that, I'm going to go to the next slide, sorry, I know you're writing, that there's no time for myths. So the writings of the Greek historian Herodotus enable us to test the rate at which a legend accumulates. The tests show that even a span of two generations is too short to allow legendary tendencies to wipe out the hard core of historical fact. So because these things were circulating during the time of the eyewitnesses, we know for a fact that there was no myth and legend. Nothing was embellished. The Gospel of John was not, Jesus' deity was not added later to the Gospel of John. You'll get that a lot because it's the most, it glorifies him most as God. And so it's just too short. Why? Because people are still alive, right? People are, when, let's say even if you die, if your son's alive and you told him a firsthand account of what happened, then still he knows what happened, right? So even two generations, maybe the third generation, by that point, you're starting to get a game of telephone going where it's like, well, who knows what happened? But there's still usually two generations is too short. So we know that if things were circulating before 100 AD, there probably is no myth and legend in the documents. So they're early, and they're trusted, and we have more of them.
they're also more accurately copied New Testament manuscripts. So we talked about the accuracy of the Old Testament, about how the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic texts were so close. And actually, the King James Bible, I don't think I wrote it in there, but the King James Bible in 1611 is actually, like, I think it's like 99% accurate to it in doctrinal content. So people are like, oh, how do you know your Bible you hold in your hands is the same as like the Masoretic or the Dead Sea Scrolls? If you compare the Dead Sea Scrolls to the King James Bible, it's like a ridiculously high percentage of accuracy. So that's something to remember too. New Testament accuracy figures, judged by words, about 95-97% plus. Judged by content, 98-99%. Because, obviously, again, we talked about there can be scribal errors with you. If you just take words by themselves, sometimes you can have misspellings or different things like that. But when you talk about content, is the doctrinal content accurate? 98-99%, yes. The message is getting through whether or not you have spelling errors, right? If someone sent you a letter saying that a publisher's clearinghouse sent you a letter saying you won $1 million and they spelled million wrong, well, you might be like, I don't know, that's publisher's clearinghouse. But let's say he shows up at your door with a check, a big check, you know, the big floppy ones. And he says, you know, you've won $1 million, and the check says, like, M-I-L-I-O-N, you know, but you verify with him that it's true. Like, you're not going to be like, no thanks, I'm not going to take that. You'd be like, no, I'm taking that to the bank, you know, and they can verify it. But there's not, you would not say, oh, something's inaccurate based on like one spelling error, the spelling errors that you're seeing. If someone wrote you an email and wrote your name wrong, even though it's your email address, I hate that. I hate when people do that. Like when they send me emails and it says S-A-R-A, even though they have my email address, which is Sarah, whatever, because I have a bunch of them, at like womenapologetics.com, and it's got an H at the end, I'm like, really? Really, like, you didn't even look. So, but I know it's to me still. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to go, oh, that's not to me because it doesn't have an H at the end. Same thing. A.T. Robertson says the real concern is with a thousandth part of the entire text, meaning that 99.9% of it is accurate. So, very, very little margin for error there. Remember I told you that we know because of the scripture quotations from the church fathers. Numerous church fathers' quotations from the New Testament allow us to reconstruct the biblical text due to their quantity and early date. 36,200 plus quotes in the New Testament in the writings of the early church fathers. There are enough quotes to offer a reconstruction of nearly the entire New Testament. So, and I think like someone even said, which this has been contested now, but you can almost reconstruct the entire thing except for like 11 verses. And if whether that's true or not, it's very close. We can basically almost reconstruct the whole thing. It says all the New Testament books are cited except for 2 John and Jude, probably because they came later, by the collective citations of Clement of Rome, Ignatius, and Polycarp by AD 110. Just for a breakdown of that, Testimony of the Fathers, Early Citations of the New Testament, someone actually went through the writings of the early church fathers and wrote how many times they quoted the New Testament and what passages. And so supposedly, again, like I said, this includes every New Testament except for 11. I don't have that list. I'm sure somebody has that somewhere. I'm sure that you can like look up what Irenaeus said about or what he wrote about the New Testament, and I'm sure you can find it somewhere. I did not verify this because I trust people who did, but if you want to do that, sounds like a great life goal. I don't have a time for that. reliability, resurrection skeptic, and atheist agnostic bar airman, so that's what I said before. This means that if historians want to know what Jesus said and did, they are more or less constrained or they have to use the New Testament Gospels as their principal sources. Let me emphasize this is not for religious or theological reasons. For instance, that these and these alone can be trusted. It is for historical reasons, pure and simple. So even he believes that the Gospels can be trusted as historical documents. Now again, he doesn't believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, or he believes that the disciples may have thought that that's what happened, but wasn't for sure. He's, you know, not a supernaturalist. So that, remember what I said about before about Richard Lewontin? He said, we can't allow a divine foot in the door. If you go in with a preconceived idea that there cannot be any supernatural events, then this is what you're going to come up with, right? You're going to say, oh, the resurrection could not have happened because of A, B, C, and D. So I spent the whole first hour on M. So we're going to try to blaze through the next few pretty quickly. Okay, do you guys need a break before I go into the next section? Yeah, okay, so I'll give you guys about 5 minutes and then we'll start. Keep on. Okay, A is for archaeology. Testimony of the stones. No archaeological evidence has ever refuted the Bible. Thousands of archaeological finds support the Bible. Again, 100 years ago, we didn't have the technology that we have in archaeology today. Today, with archaeology, the greatest thing is we actually have, like I was talking about, infrared sensors, where they can actually lay a grid of infrared lasers on the ground, and they can actually, using sonar, see what's in the ground before they even dig now. So they can decide, is it worth digging here or not? And that's actually how people decide whether or not they can do construction on historical sites and things like that, because they can determine, is this valuable for archaeological purposes? Is this a historical site? Well, they can determine that now without even digging. Whereas before, they'd have to hire an archaeologist to come and actually do a dig and find out if they could build there or not. Now they can just do it with sonar. So it's just craziness. But we didn't have that 100 years ago. And we didn't have the access to travel that we do now. So scholars were limited by where they could get in the world, how much money they had. They had to be funded by very rich people who sometimes didn't want to pay for, you know, these types of things. And so it's only within the last 100 years that we've even had archaeology as a accepted and funded discipline. But the greatest thing is since we've had it, everything we found has supported the Bible instead of controverted it. So that's been great. So Old Testament, B.C., again, we're dividing them up between B.C. and A.D. So Old Testament, B.C. Donald J. Wiseman said, the geography of biblical lands and visible remains of antiquity were gradually recorded until today, more than 25,000 sites within this region and dating to Old Testament times in their broadest sense have been located. So we've got a lot of places to choose from. The worst part is that you read the news right now, and I have like this historical and archaeological, I like subscribe to like their news updates. So every day I'm getting like, oh, ISIS blew up this historical site, or ISIS blew up this, like they found, just because they just recently drove them out of East Mosul, they were able to access this grave of a king in Nineveh. But it could have been blown to bits. And like just stuff like that just kills me. So we're finding them, and they've been recorded, luckily, but there's probably so much more, and it's all being destroyed because of what's happening in the Middle East. So that's like something that's like, ugh. But anyways, we found them, but they might be destroyed by the time you get to see them, which is sad. I'm always like, dang, I need to get over there now, but it's difficult. Anyways, this is just a list. It's not exhaustive. Only major figures of the Old Testament were represented. Basically cited in extra biblical history and archaeology. So meaning outside of the Bible, these people have been listed in other places, in historical documents and stones and things like that. And again, this is not an exhaustive list, but there's lots. Just kings of Assyria, again, Assyria had limited power from 1300 to 1000 BC, but they had a lot of contact with Israel within that time. Obviously, you've got Nineveh and Jonah and all that story, which the whole reason that Jonah didn't even want to go to Nineveh is because the Ninevites and the Assyrians were so evil and cruel. He was scared. He's like, no way, I'm not going. They're not going to change. I'm not going there. And the cruelty of the Assyrians is well known in history. And so it makes sense when people are like, well, I don't believe the story of Jonah is true. Why would he run? Well, if you knew anything about the Assyrians, you would run too. Because it would be like God asking you to go minister to ISIS in the middle of Iraq or something? Like, it's that similar. And so people are like, no, unless you're Victor Marx, when you're like, all right, I'm just going to go karate chop everybody and save kids, which is amazing. Which I don't know if you guys follow his ministry, but he is a he used to be at Calvary Marietta, and he's a martial arts, like, master. Him and his wife are both, and they started a ministry where they actually went to the Middle East, and they're rescuing kids and basically, like, fighting ISIS on the front lines where they're at. It's just crazy. And he's not afraid, because a man knows how to handle a gun and basically can kill people with one touch. So anyways. So if you're anybody but him, you might be a little bit nervous about going to Assyria. But the crazy thing is, you know, we have these lists of kings that are mentioned in scripture, but are also mentioned in history. And we have them listed in other places besides the Bible. Kings of Persia, same thing. The Persian Empire was a large part of the Old Testament. It's, you know, obviously the story of Esther. It's also the story of Daniel. You know, the prophecy of Cyrus, he's the one who let the Jews go back to their homeland, things like that. So these are very important people when they're named in history outside of the Bible. And since they're such a large part of the Old Testament, that's great for us because then we can verify those. Specific find, the Ebla tablets, 16,000 plus clay tablets that were discovered in Aleppo, Syria. Biblical cities are named, such as Sodom, Megiddo, Jerusalem, Gaza. Names such as Nahor, Israel, Eber, Michael, Ishmael. Biblical words that were thought to have developed much later. So a lot of people say, the Hebrew people didn't come around until a certain point, or that the Hebrew language is not as old as you think it is. But we are finding that we're finding words that were actually in use much earlier than these skeptical scholars are saying that they would have been around. Talks about one being who created the heavens, moon, stars, and earth from nothing 600 years before the earliest Mesopotamian account of creation. So they always say, the church borrowed from the Mesopotamian documents. They copied the story of Gilgamesh, which is Noah, and the Numa Elish is the creation story. But actually, the Ebla tablets are 600 years earlier than the Mesopotamian tablets. So it's great because it's a monotheistic deity, right? 600 years, the earliest one. So that's another proof. Ippur Papyrus. This one's crazy because the admonitions of Ippur describe conditions in Egypt that are remarkably similar to the biblical account of the Exodus plagues. Obviously, the number one thing that people are always like, oh, that didn't happen, is what Moses' story, right? They always say, Moses, there was never plagues in Egypt. They never parted the Red Sea. That just did not happen. Moses is a legend. I mean, that's the main thing. But the crazy thing is that you've got this document written by this, sorry, that got the formatting got messed up, but written by this historian named Ippur. The plague is throughout the land. The river is blood. They're groaning throughout the land. Fire mingled with hail. So it's crazy because in this document, he records conditions that are very similar to the plagues in Exodus. And so you can see that there's in the Ippur Papyrus, they've got, you know, references, and then also it's got the Exodus reference as well. So, it's almost exactly the same account. And this is an Egyptian document, which they will always say, Egypt has no proof of Israel ever being there, or of people like Moses, or anything like that. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the pharaohs are probably not correct. I don't believe Ramses II was the pharaoh in Egypt at that time. I think that was what's called an anachronism, which, because at the time that the person who was editing Moses was writing about him, it was the land of Ramesses, and so it was referred to as Ramesses' land, but I don't think Ramesses was actually the pharaoh at that point. A lot of times people are like, oh, see, the dating doesn't match up with Ramesses II. Well, probably because Ramesses II wasn't the pharaoh. But they always say that there's no Egyptian documents that show any of the biblical accounts, but we do have some. And the crazy thing is that the guy that has this is like, it's in a museum in Germany somewhere. And the guy that has it is like, yeah, it's not, it has nothing to do with the Bible. And we're like, what? Like, but he's a skeptic. And, you know, when you go in with preconceived ideas, you're not going to admit to it. Balaam inscription. 119 fragments of plaster and Aramaic text was written in black and red ink. So warnings from the book of Balaam, the son of Beor. He was a seer of the gods. And so that testament to the fact that in Numbers it talks about the different false prophets and things like that, that, you know, Balaam and the donkey and all that. So that story is verified. Jericho, excavations at Jericho and the analysis of Canaanite pottery samples have demonstrated that Jericho was conquered around 1400 BC, which is great. Because that's similar to when we believe that Joshua lived. I don't believe that's quite accurate. I believe it's a little bit earlier than that. But that means that Jericho was a fortified city before 1400 BC, right? Because if it was sacked in 1400 BC, it means it had been a city before then, which is good because we want to place Joshua's before that point. The city was destroyed by fire, the fortification walls collapsed, the destruction was in spring due to grain storage. So all of these things show that this similar account of what happened with Joshua conquering Jericho, that's basically what happened historically based on the archaeology. And if you guys haven't seen it yet, on Netflix, there's, it might still be on Netflix, maybe not, but you can probably watch it on YouTube. If you guys haven't seen Patterns of Evidence, it's a documentary. It's called Patterns of Evidence, and it's about the case for Josh. What's the name? The guy before Moses, Joseph. The case for Joseph bringing the Israelites into Egypt, and then subsequently later Moses getting them out. It's the story of that, and he gives all the historical, and it's amazing. I mean, it is literally like the evidence will blow you away. But yeah, it's called Patterns of Evidence, Exodus. So you have to watch that if you haven't yet. The Merneptah stele, or stele, Egyptian hieroglyphic slab was discovered in Pharaoh Merneptah's funerary temple in western Thebes. It contains the earliest mention of Israel from any official documents outside the Bible. So skeptics have said that Israel did not enter Canaan until the 9th century BC. However, this stele recognizes Israel as a social entity in Canaan by 1230 BC. They must have entered the land by the 13th century. That's huge because, right, we want to know that they entered the land when Joshua was living, right? So it needs to line up with the time that Jericho was sacked and all the rest of them. So the crazy thing is that this time period lines up with the archaeology of all of the areas in Canaan that were destroyed by Joshua and his troops. A Hittite seal ring. The skeptical scholars believe that the Hittites were not real people, and they were just legendary people listed in the Bible. But we found in 1905 a Hittite library with 10,000 tablets in Turkey. They had law codes, legends, covenants, myths, giving enough belief that they were probably a real people. They're the Hittite seal ring right there, so you can kind of see what it might have looked like. They used a hieroglyphic type of language, which is actually pretty advanced for the time that they were living. Very similar to Egyptian, not super similar to cuneiform, which I'm surprised because they're more that people. They're more of that type of people. They're in more of that region, but it's very similar to Egyptian hieroglyphs, which is interesting. Gath inscription, the reason this is important because it talks about Philistines and Gath, and it has names that are similar or equivalent to Goliath. And so obviously people are what, David and Goliath, that didn't really happen, right? Because David is the story of a giant who, you know, that doesn't seem like it'd be real. But we have proof that the name Goliath, the place Gath, and Philistines were actually people, and writings were recorded of them. The Tel Dan stele. Many decades, Bible critics believe David was a mythological figure due to lack of historical confirmation. However, we found this, and it says the house of David, and it's the first extra-biblical mention to the Davidic line, and actually could contain a second. Mentions biblical figures, Joram, Ahab, Ahaz, and Hadad as well. So, that's more. I'm just going to flip through these really quickly because there's a lot of them. Meshes stele, often called the Moabite stone, It records the conflict between King Mesha and King Omri of Israel, and Omri's son Ahab. Talks about their successful liberation, consistent with what would be happening to them, and is similar to the account in 2 Kings 1 through 3. Biblical figures, Mesha, Omri, Yahweh, and says possibly House of David. So the problem is that the people who know these languages, there's so few of them in the world that when we're talking about really early, like, cuneiform and early, like, proto-Hebrew and Aramaic, like, there's very few people in the world that can actually, like, read and understand these because it's a lost and dying area of scholarship. And so because there's so few people that can do this and it's so time-consuming, there's still hundreds and thousands of tablets that haven't even been translated. I mean, the British Museum has thousands and thousands of cuneiform tablets that have not been translated. And so it's crazy because there's really a need for people to get into this and learn it. Solomon's seal, a two-sided seal bearing Hebrew letters that spell Shlomo, or the Hebrew Solomon. On one side, a dignified bearded man bearing a scepter on the reverse, which may be a depiction of King Solomon. It dates from the 9th to 7th centuries BC, which would put him right in the right time period. Annals of Sennacherib, also known as the Taylor Prism, is a six-sided clay prism. It's cuneiform. Records the campaigns of King Sennacherib against Judah and King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. Basically, it records the same thing as 2 Kings in the book of Isaiah. And talks about King Hezekiah and all that. So basically says the same thing the Bible says. Hezekiah Bulla, 8th century BC, Bulla or seal, basically of King Ahaz's son, King Hezekiah. It reads, belonging to Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, the king of Judah. So the great thing about that is that gives us three pieces of information, right? Not just one. So now we know not only is Hezekiah a real person, but Ahaz is a real person and Judah was a real place. And so, you know, it's great because you can get this really tiny, I mean, we're talking about like it's half an inch wide, but you can get lots of information off of it. So Babylonian Chronicles describes Nebuchadnezzar's first decade as king along with his political and military exploits, including his invasion of Jerusalem. These correspond to the activities in Jeremiah, 2 Chronicles, 2 Kings, and confirm the historicity of Nebuchadnezzar II, which is described in the book of Daniel. Jehoiakim, ration record. Obviously, there were rations at the time that Judah was taken captive, and so they had to ration out foods. Because they weren't willing to let them basically just eat whatever they wanted. So this would be an example of ration to the king of Judah. Cylinder of Nabonidus. I always don't want to say those wrong. Talks about Belshazzar, which people who previously thought was legendary or the Bible mistakenly identified him as a king since he was absent from a lot of other kings' lists. It confirms the historical figure that he was Nabonidus' son, a co-regent. It explains why Daniel could rise to no higher than the third ruler in the kingdom. So it's crazy because people didn't realize Belshazzar was an actual historical figure. And so they never understood why Daniel was only third when there was just one king. They're like, well, why is he third if there's one king and he's supposedly the greatest out of everybody? Shouldn't he be second, right? Well, it's because this guy ruled alongside his son. So he was a co-regent, which means that there were two kings at the time, which is why Daniel could never rise more than third. So it's interesting when you learn these kinds of things because you're like, oh, that makes sense, right? Cyrus cylinder, this one was the describes when Cyrus, it's basically his declaration letting the Jews go back to their homeland, which is, you know, prophesied by Isaiah and then recorded in Nehemiah. Darius the First and Xerxes. This shows Persian King Darius the First sitting on the throne and his son Xerxes, or Ahasuerus and Esther, facing him with guards behind. So this is just a relief, proving they're historical figures. We also have a silver bowl, which has on the around the outside, it's an inscription. Basically, talks about Xerxes and Artaxerxes and Darius. And all the Persian kings. There's also the Ahab ring. It talks about Ahab, king of Israel. And it describes the fact that he had lots of military strength and records the same thing as 1 Kings 21:25. We have the Jezebel seal, which obviously this kind of proves that she kind of wore the pants in the relationship, meaning that she was not content to be what other queens of that time would have been. She wanted her own seal and wanted to seal documents of her own and wanted some type of power, which corresponds with the biblical record of her, right? She was constantly trying to usurp, right, power. So she has her own seal for sealing documents. Edwin Yamamuchi says, until the breakthrough of archaeological discoveries, the stories about the biblical patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were subject to considerable skepticism in the last 30 years. However, a steadily increasing flow of materials from Mesopotamia and Syria, Palestine, from Mari, from Nuzi, has convinced all except for a few holdovers of the authenticity of the patriarchal narratives. So the Old Testament is obviously the most contested, right? Because people are like, oh, it happened too long ago. We have no evidence. We can't prove that actually happened. All the supernatural stuff throws people off, but we have a lot of archaeological evidence to prove that those things did happen, those people did exist. Now we just have to talk about the supernatural aspect of it. Did the supernatural happen? Really quickly, I'm going to flip through the New Testament. So archaeology, New Testament would be AD. New Testament figures cited by extra-biblical history and archaeology, so all these people are listed. Again, only major figures are listed in places outside of the Bible, New Testament. So if you're ever like, oh, what's a denarii? When they talked about how they paid them in denarii or whatever, like that's what it would look like. So, and then we have Pontius Pilate, bronze coin. Roman emperors, same thing. We have Roman emperors who are very involved in what was happening in the Christian church in the first century. So it's great that we have historical record of these Roman emperors as well and what was happening with them. Archaeological discoveries specifically related to Jesus. You've got Jesus' hometown, Nazareth. I'll just go through these one by one. Why is that important? Because 50 years ago, they didn't believe Nazareth was actually a place. So they said that the record about Jesus was not accurate because Nazareth wasn't a place. However, we have found Nazareth. So, Pilate inscription, Pontius Pilate's name in stone. Why is that important? Because Pontius Pilate is what the person who sentenced Jesus to die at the cross. So if he doesn't exist, we have no crucifixion. So it's important that Pilate existed. Caiaphas, the high priest of Jesus' time. Why is it important that he's in history? Because what? He's the one who ruled over the trial, right? That brought him before Pilate to decide Jesus' death. Yohanan, a crucifixion victim from AD 70, was found in 1968. Why is that important? Because skeptical scholars say the crucifixion was not actually happening at the time that Jesus was crucified, that Roman crucifixion was not happening, and that it wasn't a form of death until later. But we have actually found a crucifixion victim from that time that proves that the crucifixion was happening in that way at that time. The Nazareth decree, slab of stone with a decree from Emperor Claudius not to move bodies under pain of death. Note, this is to say nothing of the numerous places, waters, and cities named in the Gospels, as well as geographical and topical details. Obviously, we can go to these places today that are mentioned in the New Testament, so it's like, oh, I don't believe Jerusalem was there. Well, you can go walk around in it, so I'm pretty sure it was there. So there's lots of things that we can still today even say without archaeology, these things are rooted in a historical regional place. So Jesus' hometown of Nazareth, really quickly, that's a picture of the site, 1955 it was found. Jerusalem, obviously where Jesus lived, taught, worked wonders, and died, you can go there today. Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judah, so this is the Pilate inscription. And look, it's dated right around the time that we need him to live, right? Ossuary of Joseph Caiaphas, the high priest, same thing. He also lives around the same time that we need him. I actually remember when this was discovered. I was obviously alive at this point. And I remember hearing about this and what a controversy it was because people were like, nope, that's not who it is. And then, you know, then there was a big one about James, the brother of Jesus, too, the James ossuary. Crucifixion victim, so that's what it looked like. So they found the actual nail with the wood and the foot and all that. I know, can you imagine? Site of an empty tomb, similar like Jesus' tomb. So places, people really did bury their loved ones in places like Jesus would have been buried. Jacob's well,
and was located in ancient Samaria. They still have it today. It still produces fresh, cool water from an underground spring, so you can go see it. Herod inscription, we found a wineskin that has Herod, king of Judah, on it. Obviously, that's important because what Herod was the king that lived when Jesus was born and was the one who wanted to kill all the babies, right? Caesar Augustus, this proves that, you know, he existed and that there were coins that had Caesar's image on it, right? Because what happened in the Gospels, they said, well, should we pay our taxes? Whose image is on this coin? Caesar's. Render to Caesar. So you can see there were coins that had Caesar's likeness on them. Sergius Paulus, an inscription. Basically, one of Paul's first converts to Christianity during his first missionary journey, they had inscriptions with his name on them. A second inscription was found in Rome, where he returned to, so we know that the history in Acts is verified by archaeology. Gallio inscription, the 1st century AD inscription drawing by Claudius, found in Delphi, Greece, describes a biblical figure Gallio, who is listed in Acts 18, the proconsul of Achaia, in office to whom the apostle Paul was brought before judgment. So, Erastus inscription, this records the biblical name, the name of the biblical figure Erastus, mentioned multiple places. It says Erastus, curator of public buildings, laid this pavement at his own expense. So you know how sometimes like people who like contribute to a building, they get a little plaque. It's kind of the same thing. Ephesus, obviously you can go there today, right? The temple and the what's that thing called?
Amphitheater.
Yes, thank you, amphitheater. I can't think of the name. Amphitheater, they're still there. You can go see them. And, you know, it's where Paul spent a lot of his time. Nelson Gluck said, it may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. So, obviously, everything that we have found has supported the Bible and has never contradicted it. In extraordinary ways, modern archaeology has affirmed the historical core of the Old and New Testaments, corroborating key portions of the story of Israel's patriarchs, Exodus, the Davidic monarchy, and the life and times of Jesus. Those four things are important because they're the four most contested periods of biblical archaeology. Israel's patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, people are like, oh, they never lived. They're mythological. The Exodus, obviously that didn't happen, right? Because who's going to part the Red Sea? That doesn't happen. The Davidic monarchy, that David does not have a claim to the throne of Israel. Why? Why is that a big deal now? Because then who has a claim to Israel? The Jews, and that's what they're fighting over. And the life and times of Jesus, because if Jesus didn't exist and didn't die on the cross and didn't rise from the dead, then there's no point, right? okay, P.S. for prophecy. I may have to go through S next week before the other one, which I probably will have time because the topic next week is not long. We'll just see how far we can get in prophecy, and then I'll finish the rest next week. Okay. The Messiah. Obviously, the most important part of prophecy is what? The prophecies of Jesus. So I'm going to focus on those for a minute. Sometime before the 500 BC, the prophet Daniel proclaimed that Israel's long-awaited Messiah would begin his public ministry 483 years after issuing a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. The decree regarding the restoration of Jerusalem was issued by Persia's King Artaxerxes to the Hebrew priest Ezra in 458 BC. 483 years later, the ministry of Jesus Christ began in Galilee. Now, at the bottom of each one of these is going to be the probability of chance fulfillment, meaning that out of the historical chances that this could possibly happen, this is what it is. So 1 in 10 to the 5th. So 1 in 10 to the 5th is basically 1 with... or 10 with 5 zeros after. So 1 in, and then 10 with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, wait. Okay. So 1 in a million. My math is awful. So the chances are 1 in a million that this would actually come to cross. Okay, of course it does, right? Because we know that it happened. Also, in approximately 700 BC, the prophet Micah named the tiny village of Bethlehem as a birthplace of Israel's Messiah. The fulfillment of this prophecy in the birth of Christ is one of the most widely known and widely celebrated facts in history, right? Anybody that knows the Christmas story knows he was born in Bethlehem. Like, there's no contesting of that. Everyone agrees to that. Probability and chance of fulfillment, same, 1 in 1 million, right?
So there's a chance that one in a million it could possibly happen. The Messiah. In the 5th century B.C., a prophet named Zechariah declared the Messiah would be betrayed for the price of a slave, 30 pieces of silver. And also that this money would be used to buy a burial ground for Jerusalem's poor foreigners. Obviously, we know that's what happens, right? Which is scary. Probability of chance of fulfillment. Now, this is even less.
That would happen in this way. 1 in, what, 10 with 11? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
Okay, so 1 in that many, whatever that is, billion, trillion, that this would actually happen. And, of course, we know, based on the Old Testament or the New Testament, that it did. The crucifixion. Some 400 years before the crucifixion was invented, the art of crucifixion, both Israel's King David and the prophet Zechariah described the Messiah's death in words that perfectly depict the mode of execution. Further, they said the body would be pierced and none of the bones would be broken, which is contrary to what they actually do. When someone's on the cross, sometimes they last a long time. And so they're like, okay, we're done with this. After a few days, we don't want to deal with this person on the cross anymore. We just want to get them done and buried. So they break their kneecaps because that way what it causes them to sag and they can't lift themselves up to breathe. So they actually drown, suffocate basically, because they can't hold themselves up. So they always break the legs. But it said that Jesus' legs would not be broken in this mode of execution, which was not likely. Again, historians obviously confirmed Jesus died on the cross. And they did not break his bones because he decided when he was going to die. He gave up his spirit, and he didn't need them to do it for him. A spear was thrust into his side to verify that he was indeed dead. Also talks about his side being pierced. Probability of chance of fulfillment, add two more zeros. So one in, can I move the commas? One in even more ridiculous amount of chances that that would come true, right? Cyrus, obviously we just talked about this, prophet Isaiah foretold the conqueror named Cyrus would destroy Babylon, which at the time was an impregnable fortress. There was no way you could attack Babylon and subdue Egypt, which was also a huge power. It's like, are you going to kill both Babylon and Egypt? Like, that's crazy. Obviously later on, Alexander like wiped everybody out, but at the time, it seemed unimaginable. Isaiah made this prophecy 150 years before Cyrus was born. 180 years before Cyrus performed any of these feats, and he did actually perform them all, and 80 years before the Jews were even taken into exile. So to prophesy that this guy would release the Jews from exile when they aren't even in exile yet, like, what? Like, it just seems odd, right? Probably a chance of fulfillment. Two more zeros. One in that many. Destruction of Babylon. Mighty Babylon seemed impossible, like I said, to destroy, yet two Bible prophets declare its doom. They further claim that the ruins would be avoided by travelers, the city would never again be inhabited, and that its stones would not even be moved for use as building material, Isaiah and Jeremiah, and both of those things actually happened. This one's a little less likely that it might happen, so 1 in 10 with like 9, so here. That's 9. Still very unlikely. Nation of Israel, Prophet Moses said that the Jewish nation would be conquered twice and that the people would be carried off as slaves each time, first by the Babylonians and then by a fourth world kingdom, which ended up being Rome. Then Moses said the second conqueror would take the Jews captive to Egypt in ships, selling them or giving them away as slaves to all parts of the world. Both of these were fulfilled. And then God said the Jews would remain scattered throughout the entire world for many generations. So it's crazy because obviously after 70 AD, the Jews have not, I mean, until 1948, they didn't return to Israel as their homeland between 70 AD and, I mean, and he said they would be dispersed for generations. So, and they would be so assimilated into peoples of other nations. But that they would one day return to the land of Palestine to reestablish for a second time their nation, which is crazy because that came true in our lifetime. Well, not mine, but 1948. My grandma's lifetime. But, I mean, that just recently came true. So, you know, skeptics before 1948 were probably like, yeah, right, that's never going to happen, right? But then it happened. They were probably like, probably a chance of fulfillment, 1 in 10 to the 20th. So now I got, like, 5 million of these things out here. I'm just going across the board here. the chance that this would happen. Edom, Jeremiah predicted that despite its fertility and despite the accessibility of its water supply, the land of Edom would become a barren, uninhabited wasteland. It actually is now a very bleak region, and so that came true. 1 in 10 to the 5th. So 1 in 1 million. Jericho. Joshua prophesied that Jericho would be rebuilt by one man. He also said the man's eldest son would die when the reconstruction began, and his youngest son would die when the work reached completion. About 5 centuries later, this prophecy found its fulfillment in the life and family of a man named, I don't know if you say it Hiel or Hill, but it's recorded in 1 Kings. Elijah's rapture. The day of Elijah's supernatural departure from earth was predicted unanimously and accurately by a group to the eyewitness account. 50 prophets in 2 Kings 2. Obviously, the chance of that happening is like, yeah, right, but it did. 2 Chronicles 20. Jehaziel prophesied that King Jehoshaphat and a tiny band of men would defeat an enormous, well-equipped, and well-trained army without even having to fight. Just as predicted, the king and his troops stood looking on as their foes were supernaturally destroyed to the last man. So that was the one where the angel of the Lord swept in and destroyed the whole army. Since these 13 prophecies cover mostly separate and independent events, the probability of chance occurrence in all for all 13 is 1 in 10 to 138 zeros, which I'm not going to write on the board. For the sake of putting the figure into perspective, this probability can be compared to the statistical chance that the second law of thermodynamics will be reversed in a given situation. That chance is 1 in 10 to the 80th zero. Stating that it's simply based on these 13 prophecies alone, the Bible record may be said to be vastly more reliable than the second law of thermodynamics. And if you just talk about the messianic prophecies, I didn't go through this, but you should check out a book called, I don't remember what it's called, but it's by Mervyn Bittinger. And he is a mathematician who did the math of the probability of the messianic prophecies. It's called The Mathematics. I want to say it's like The Mathematics of the Bible or something like that. He's a mathematician. He writes mathematic textbooks, so he's legitimate. But he wrote a book about the mathematic probabilities of the messianic prophecies. And it's amazing what he writes. But he's a good one to look up. Mervyn Bittinger. I might actually get done. I'm going to go real quickly. Actually, you know what? No, I'm going to save science for next week, and I'm going to actually show you his prophecies, because I have them. I just got to go to a different PowerPoint presentation.
The faith equation?
Yes, the faith equation. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so here it is. We'll just go through this real quick. Slideshow, present review. Oh, man, didn't do it. Come on. What's going to think? Okay, here we go. Okay, one of the strongest evidences the Bible is inspired by God is its predictive prophecy. Unlike any other book, the Bible offers a multitude of specific predictions, some hundreds of years in advance, that have been literally fulfilled or else point to a definite future time when they will come true. In his comprehensive catalog of prophecies, Encyclopedia of Biblical Prophecies, which is probably a good book to pick up, J. Barton Payne lists 1,817 predictions in the Bible, 1,239 in the Old Testament, and 578 in the New. So he went through and he listed out all of the specific predictions in the Bible. All of which have come true, if someone handed you a book and said, 2,000 of the predictions in this book have come true, I think you'd be like, okay, I'm convinced, right? But for whatever reason, people are not convinced by that, because like I said, they've got that block, but we have almost 2,000, so it's crazy. And then specifically Jesus, so this is the work of Dr. Geisler and Dr. Bittinger, kind of mixed. Obviously, the human race, Jesus had the bullseye, Genesis 3:15. He also is the right ethnic group. He's from the people of Abraham. He's from the tribe of Judah. He's from the dynasty of David. He was born of a virgin, right? The how? where Bethlehem and when, well, maybe, that's why it says circa 3380, or 30 AD if you believe he was born in 4 BC, depending on what you believe. Daniel 9:24. Oh, man. Okay, well, I'll just do this really quickly. So, seed of the woman, line of Seth, descendant of Shem, offspring of Abraham, tribe of Judah, from the house of David, son of a virgin, born in Bethlehem. He would die, like I said, circa sometime 33 AD. He would be heralded by a forerunner. He'd be proclaimed as a king. He would suffer and die for our sins. His side would be pierced. He would rise from the dead. So here's 14, right? Just 14 things that we know have come true, right? So the mathematical probabilities. He says the possibility of, or the probability of 9 prophecies coming true of Christ is 1 in 10 to the 76th power. That means that's 1, or that's 10 with 76 zeros at the end, right? 1 in 10 with 76 zeros. That's a big number. All right, so to give you an idea of the scope of that, so 9, so we talked, 14 came true that we just looked at, more, obviously half, but 14 in that particular picture. 9 coming true is like 1 in 10 to the 76th. To get an idea of what that means, 1 in 10 to the 17th power is like finding one grain of sand in a domed football stadium filled with sand, right? Finding a particular grain of sand in a football stadium filled with sand. 1 in 10 to the 76th power is like picking the same grain of sand 4 times in succession. So it's like basically impossible. There are only 10 to the 60th power atoms in the whole universe. And he talks about this in his book, Faith Equation. And he sold over 12 million college math texts. So, I mean, the evidence is there. The probability, the mathematical probabilities are there. And if we can, and that's why I go in this order, maps, because if we can prove that the Bible is, has good manuscript evidence, that it's rooted in history, and that it does have archaeological evidence, then when it comes to this, the prophecy, then now we can trust that it is dated correctly, and that the prophecies therein were written and said at the time that they were actually recorded. And so we know that they are predictive, meaning they were written way before they actually came to pass. So when you're trying to make a case, you always want to start with the natural and then go into the supernatural. The science is just a fun one that I add at the end. But, you know, you always want to start with something that people can understand and then move into the part where they're like, okay, now I'm going to have to think a little. Or be willing to suspend my disbelief for a minute. So this is a good order to go in. But I'm going to stop there because my voice is giving out. And science is a great fun section, and we'll do that before we do postmodernism next week. So anybody have any questions before we end?
You overwhelmed us.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This topic is like, there's so much. And the reason that I do put so much in there is because I want people to see, I want the shock value of how much there is to be like, oh, wow, there's a lot. And even if you can't retain it all, at least you know that there's a lot. And, you know, in that way, if you ever want to study on your own or learn more about each section, at least you have somewhere to go from here. But yeah, when I give this talk, they usually give me about 45 minutes to do this talk. And I'm like, what? So I have to cut things out. But I try to give them enough to where like they feel overwhelmed. And so it's so funny because one of the guys that asked me to come speak, he was like, I don't think you're going to get through all that in 45 minutes. But some of the slides are mostly for shock value. Obviously, I don't go through each one of the Assyrian kings and each one of the Persian kings. But that's shock value. That tells you, oh, there's a lot of external evidence for the Bible in history that wow, there's huge lists. So a lot of it is just mostly for shock value. But, you know, I obviously don't go through all of it.
Where would we find that, though? Like, I've had people say that to me. Oh, the Bible's not accurate.
Right.
It's just people wrote it in order to control other people, and you know, they make those
right
kind of statements. But where do you go to find this kind of?
Okay, so these I have a. Let me go to my sources. I'll show you the slide. It has my sources on it. One you can go to that I didn't list is obviously Martin Bittinger's book, but you also have. Dr. Holden and Dr. Geisler just recently published a book called The Handbook of Biblical Archaeology, and it's a comprehensive list of all the archaeological finds from, like, the first find to up to, like, last year or 2 years ago. Dr. Holden, he worked on it for years. I would go to his, he was my mentor. I'd go to his office and he'd have, like, you know, he's a typical professor, he'd have piles of books, like, everywhere, like, every archaeological book you could find was on his desk, and he was basically pulling everything in order to put it in this encyclopedia. So that's a great one. I think it's called The Popular Handbook of Biblical Archaeology by Dr. Holden and Dr. Geisler. That's a good one. The list of resources. Come on. Oh, not that one. This one. There we go. So manuscripts and archaeology. The archaeology slides and manuscript slides, you can actually order those at the PowerPoint presentation from veritasseminary.com/MIS or miscellaneous resources. So you can actually order that, the PowerPoint. And all of Dr. Geisler's slides you can also order on a flash drive as well if you want to get those. And then prophecy, most of the prophecy I pulled was from the Reasons to Believe Ministry website. So RTV, or reasons.org, has a lot of prophecy stuff. And then another book that I used is The Search for Messiah by Mark Eastman and Chuck Smith. I love that book, The Search for Messiah. You can just read it like a novel, like it's not boring, but it has a lot of research. And then the science section, I used Science in the Bible, The Remarkable Record of Job, and The Creator Beyond Time and Space. So a lot of the science, I use Henry Morris and then Hugh Ross to give both sides of the young earth and old earth side of things. Once I'm done, I'll put this on the website. The thing is that because they're on the Google Drive, they're downloadable. I don't mind if you guys download these and use them, as long as you give credit. So, like, for example, like I say, these are Dr. Geisler and Joseph Holden's. Like, just when you give the presentation, like, don't like try to sell it or like, you know, like, I want you guys to have these things, but they were given to me with the understanding that I would give them to people that are trustworthy and would use the right, you know. So I don't mind if you guys download these and have them. And if you end up getting a chance to talk to somebody or teach a class, like, please, by all means, use them. But just don't try to sell them or pass them off as your own original work or, you know, something like that. I just have to say that, you know, because they are online. I have to say, and only you guys have access to that site, that the Google Drive. So, but definitely, you know, I want you guys to be able to use these to lead people to Christ or to teach others how to do that. But just try to have integrity when you do.
No, I was just thinking, like, where do you refer other people who are arguing with you? Like, the Bible is not accurate. Like, you know, I can make statements. I heard this in my class, but they're like,
right.
I mean, anybody.
Well, you have to
really
reference.
Want to have the discussion is going
to
come up.
Right. You have to reference experts.
Yeah.
You have to appeal to authority. I mean, that's really. I mean, people say that's like a fallacy, that appealing to authority. But you know what? You have to. Like Marvin Bittinger, no one's going to question his mathematical prowess because of who he is and what he's done.
Right.
You know, no one's going to question Hugh Ross on science. You know, they'll question Henry Morris because he's young earth and more people are going to be opposed to that than like an old earther. But I mean, the science that Reasons to Believe does is so well done, and they're all biologists, and I mean, they've all got the credentials, you know. So that's the thing, is that like, if someone's not willing to take an authority's answer, then they're not going to take anybody. So I would just say, have the authority along with the fact, you know. Say, oh, well, this guy Bart Ehrman said this. Well, everyone's going to take Bart Ehrman's word for it because he's a New Testament scholar, he's well respected, and he's not even a Christian, he's not even a believer, so he's an easy one to quote without people like arguing with you about it. I would just say appeal to authority, you know, because even like, so I didn't come up with this stuff. Like, I didn't go dig up these things and say this is what. No, but you know, but they, it is a tested fact, and there are people who have these things lying in museum places, and you can actually go touch them and see them, and, you know. So, I mean, I've seen the Dead Sea Scrolls with my own eyes. Like, I know how amazing they are, so I know they exist. So, yeah. I mean, I would just say appeal to authority.